Imagine a future of driving cars. Cars that just drive themselves. Imagine a future where you work from home. Yeah, I'm not talking about like the year 2075. I'm talking about now. Let's talk and learn more about disrupted cities. Thank you for listening and thank you for subscribing to Learning More. It's Russ with you. This week, we are talking about disrupted cities. And what do we mean by that? Well, cities are changing, right? Cities are changing because of ways everything is changing. You've got cars changing. You've got work from home. You've got shopping malls going away because of things like Amazon. A lot of change in cities. And when you drive around, you can't help but see empty buildings in many cases because they don't have perhaps another use for those buildings. In looking for a home, you see highlighted two-car garage. How many of us actually park a car in a garage? I haven't parked a car in a garage in maybe 15 years. I've got other stuff in there that I can't do. We've got it set up like a little second living room out in our garage. It's usable space that we're using in different ways. And that's sort of our conversation today about disrupted cities. Like, what do we do and how do we adjust for change? Because the coronavirus has kicked us all into high gear as far as this change goes. So last week, we talked about the Olympics and the modern Olympic ruins. So I talked to Mark after the podcast. I was like, I got to have you back so that we can talk about changing cities. So Mark Wilson, a professor of Urban and Regional Planning School of Planning, Design, and Construction at Michigan State University. Mark Wilson, thank you for joining me again.
Thanks, Russ. It's good to be back.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. I had to have this talk with you because when we talked last time about the Olympics, I was like, okay, we got to talk about these changes in cities because there's so much that has been really forced to change by the pandemic over the last year that we really didn't expect. I did a story on my other podcast. I have a daily podcast called This Is Today, which that was a shameless plug for it just then. But we talked about the iPhone, the invention of the iPhone, right? And how people were ready for it. People were excited for it. But check this out. AT&T, they didn't really know how to support the data. They didn't know how much data was going to happen. And in fact, they even sent a 300-page phone bill to somebody in a box because they detailed each data transaction. So they weren't ready with their infrastructure for it. So that made me think, I did that story right after our talk. I was like, shoot, is our infrastructure in the United States like ready for this change? Can we actually move forward?
I think there's a lot to take into account when we look at disruption and technological change. And I think that many forget just how disruptive a new technology can be, especially when it has unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So it's not simply that a new technology emerges, it is the sequence, the cascading events that are associated with this. And for me, I think one of the greatest challenges is between the engineering and scientific development of a technology and the social context into which it is placed. Mm. And one of the reasons this is so hard is because those working on the technology are very familiar with it. They understand what's happening. But those outside that sphere may not be aware it's coming, mm-hmm. may not be aware that it's happening. And it's only when it becomes popularly known do we then start having to shape the social environment for this right. new technology. And right. so often a technology hits, and for those that are making it, they've seen it coming for decades. For those for whom it's new, they haven't really prepared. Right. And we made this case. We have a group at MSU called the Sociomobility Group. And what we did was connect engineers and social scientists around new technology, especially mobility like autonomous vehicles, because we realized that we were working in two separate spheres and weren't really aware of what the other was trying to achieve. And so what we find is that a technology will arrive and suddenly there is a need for new laws or rules or social practices or behaviors that we're not ready for.
Right.
And so as we was looking at the cusp of autonomous vehicles, the planning profession had barely begun thinking about what it means for cities. So we have this lag between the arrival of a new technology and the social context for that technology being able to accommodate it.
Cars are the biggest example there right now, I think, at least for me. I think about, I would love to have a self-driving car. I would love to be able to just sit back, relax, and, you know, go on that 4-hour drive and actually enjoy the scenery, because I'm always the driver in the family, so I never get to like look at stuff. It'd be great to push a button. But the roads, are they even set up for that? Can we actually really like legitimately have autonomous vehicles the way that our roads are set up?
I think that there's a lot that will change. Some of it is the roads, but we can look to when the automobile came about. So 100 years ago, when the automobile first came onto our streets, we had laws about people walking in front with flags. There was one great community that had a rule that if a horse was approaching you, you had to disassemble your vehicle and cover it with camouflage so as not to scare the animal. So adjusting to technology is nothing new. But there were also, when the automobile first came out, forces that tried to change how we behaved. So before the automobile, pedestrians ruled the streets. With the arrival of the automobile, there was competition for street space and who had the right to be where. And so there was a big push by those that wanted to promote driving to make a crime out of wandering around the street. And so jaywalking was invented as a reaction to the automobile. So I say this by looking back. I am looking back to look forward. So to return to your question, is the context ready yet for autonomous vehicles? And in some ways, yes, many of the roads work for autonomous vehicles. But is there going to be too much road space? Are we going to have too many parking areas that we won't know how to deal with? But I think that what is perhaps more complex about the transition to autonomous vehicles is, again, some of these social structures. Will people feel comfortable? Will they trust them? What will the insurance industry do? What will the insurance be on autonomous vehicles? Yeah. So it's a lot of these social institutional elements that will shape how we adjust. And so the autonomous vehicle at the moment is both good and bad. I call them Schrodinger's vehicles, like the old thought experiment, because the thought experiment was that you could have multiple states existing. Because I can imagine a city where you introduce an autonomous vehicle that becomes very positive because of the social context, the rules that are changed, the way people behave. But I can also imagine the same vehicle in an identical community being chaotic simply because of those reactions. So at the moment, autonomous vehicles are everything to every person. And you see in the autonomous vehicle what you want to believe as being this great asset, or as a disaster. And of course, the truth is between those.
Right. And you bring up an interesting point about this, just the amount of roads that we have, parking spaces, driveways, garages. In the world of autonomous vehicles, be sharing a vehicle, only using a vehicle, which, you know, obviously there's some great things there for the environment. There's great things there for savings and gas, savings in cash, and because you don't have to buy this car. You're just essentially renting it whenever you need it. Yeah. Are people going to want to do that? Like, I see that as like a problem of trying to get people to make that leap into that.
Yeah. And I think you captured one of the interesting aspects is, what do people think of when they think of autonomous vehicles? Do they think, I will own a vehicle that is mine that will be autonomous, which planners dread? Because it means it takes you to work and comes back empty, and then it comes in empty to get you and takes you home. You've doubled the amount of miles driven.
Right.
Whereas a lot of planners think, oh, this is essentially going to be ride-hailing without a driver. It will be one vehicle that's constantly moving, and it drops off one person, picks up another. It's electric, hopefully from sustainable sources, environmental pluses, fewer spaces required for our communities to house vehicles. But it depends on what people imagine when they think of AVs. because right. they may be rudely awakened when they're thinking, I'll buy an AV and it will just be mine, to thinking, oh, I'm going to be jumping in and out of different vehicles all the time in mm-hmm. order to get around. We don't right. really have a sense yet of how it's going to unfold.
Like, I just started taking some golf lessons. Mm-hmm. I kind of like just keeping the golf clubs in the trunk, you know? So it's like, oh, well, I'm by a course. I can just go, you know, hit a few.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have that anymore. Or I just want to go for a drive. I just want to, you know, do this. I sort of have to schedule that, I would think, you know, with a rideshare. So that said, I like the other side of it where I don't have to deal with the maintenance of the vehicle, perhaps. You know, I don't have to deal with any of like the insurance. I've got maybe some sort of shared plan or whatever it is. Who knows what that's going to be? That's a whole other thing. But it seems like there's a lot of benefits on both sides of that. But I think the big benefit would be if we can have less cars. That helps us all, right?
Yeah. And I think that part of that is that our cities are heavily influenced by the transportation systems that are available. Mm-hmm. So early cities were designed for people who walked.
Right.
And so the cities weren't very big. You could walk around for an hour and
right
you
there
cross
in the heart.
It.
And the it's roads right are really there. Small too.
Yeah. And you can see this in American cities that started out that way. So looking at Boston or Manhattan or Philadelphia or San Francisco. That they started out as non-vehicle cities and they're fairly dense and they evolved as a certain way of life. Then we add different types of transport on top and we get a different type of city. And you can see that in places like Phoenix where they sprawl out, or Los Angeles where they grew when the automobile was dominant and therefore they grew as automobile cities. Mm-hmm. Older cities that had to adapt the automobile or to the automobile are very different. And so you can see them sequencing of downtown was built for a certain mode. The suburbs were built differently. So mm-hmm. cities are constantly adapting to their footprint and changing it for the transport. The problem is when you create a city for one type of transport, like the automobile, it's very hard to retrofit right. because public transit needs a fair amount of density to be profitable and cost effective. But if you don't have high density, then you don't have good potential for public transit.
No, the public transit system, it's tough because you've got to rely on schedules and whatnot. You can't just kind of go spur of the moment. Mm. And that's, I think, some of the argument for people that don't take public transportation. Yeah. Well, okay, the autonomous vehicle sort of fixes that, alters that because maybe you're able to reserve a car or however it's going to work. Who knows? That's the car side of it. That's the city side of it. We've got garages at our houses. What are we going to do with those?
Garages to me are fascinating simply because they are such a central piece. And if you go down many areas of suburban America, you will see a third of the frontage of a house is taken up by a garage and its doors. And so it takes up a lot of space. And if we didn't need those garages, we could have denser housing. If we converted garages into sort of dwelling areas or apartments or just more living space, then we would be able to have more people living in different neighborhoods. And so for the engineering and design side, this is quite straightforward and easy to do. And there are many communities that promote the adaption of garages into apartments or extra dwelling spaces because it cuts the pressure on rent and it mm-hmm. makes more spaces available. Mm-hmm. The trouble is, what do your neighbors think?
Right.
What will the local planning regulations say? What would your right. neighbors think if you say, I'm going to turn my garage into an Airbnb? Mm-hmm. Suddenly you end up with not the technical ability to convert a garage, which happens daily, and is easy to do, versus the social and economic and political realm of having a garage that is now an apartment that is rented mm-hmm. out. That's a whole different set of decisions.
Right.
And those decisions will vary. California actually is quite proactive in promoting garage conversions, but other states are not.
Yeah.
And California is doing it because of the high cost of living and the desire to get more and more living units into those cities to take some pressure off rents.
Right. Well, yeah, and they've even allowed some buildings in the backyard, converting spaces like that. Mm. It's dependent upon the counties here in California. They're like, my county? No. they're pretty strict about it.
Well, and that's why I get to my Schrodinger metaphor. It's like two counties that are identical. One has one set of rules. One has a different set. And we can look at either as a possibility, but it's hard to predict what the norm will become until we've seen it happen for a few years at least.
All right. So we talked a bit about cars and houses. A lot of people are moving now into their houses as far as their office space goes. Mm-hmm. And that's been really pushed because of the pandemic. Also, shopping malls. I mentioned that earlier. We'll talk about office spaces, shopping malls. We'll try to come up with some solutions for that when we come back. We'll be right back. If you enjoy history, maybe you're just feeling a little nostalgic, or you wonder who's having a birthday today, or maybe you need a reason to celebrate. Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It is called This Is Today. And each and every day, we talk about the historic events, celebrity birthdays. We also talk about whatever is going on today. There's always something to celebrate when you listen to This Is Today. And at just 10 minutes each day, you can make it a daily habit. You can even add it to your Alexa Flash briefing. Click the link in the description or just search in your favorite podcast app for This Is Today. All right. Thank you for listening and subscribing to Learning More. I'm talking with Mark Wilson. We're talking about disrupted cities. We've talked about cars, and there's a lot to unpack there as far as what we've got to deal with for the future of our cities. But one other thing that we're really dealing with right now is work from home. And I am seeing so many office spaces for lease in my community, and I'm sure that's what's going on throughout the country. Salesforce opened up a huge thing in San Francisco. I mean, this building is massive, and they're saying now that a lot of people can work from home. What do we do with all this empty office space?
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of the big challenges about remaking cities. And work from home has been possible for quite a while. And some of my early work was on the impact of the internet. And in the early 90s, there was a movement for telework and the ability for people to work remotely. And it never really caught on. And one of the primary reasons was that the management structure of the time, and even to this day, required presentism, that people be seen, be in the office, that work only takes place when I can see my staff working. And so there was a huge trust issue. Mm-hmm. And even though we've got more and more effective at working remotely because of the technologies available and the softwares and systems in place, we still didn't see a huge switch until COVID. And right. So COVID, to me, has accelerated so many social changes. And now we're going to move into the post-pandemic adjustment phase, mm-hmm. where we have to reorder our cities to take it into account. And you mentioned shopping, but I'll focus now on offices. And so now people are working from home. They're happier. They're not having to commute as far. Mm-hmm. The amount of traffic in some cities has dropped dramatically. But what COVID did more than anything else was prove that working from home worked or didn't. And this will be up to you as a worker and your employer. Mm-hmm. But you may well have evidence that your work from home, in fact, led to more productivity rather than less. Mm-hmm. And so there is now a case that can be made either to require you to come back because you were less productive at home, or for you to argue, I want to stay because I was more productive at home, or for a hybrid of some days at home, some days at work. And so this has really broken one of those social molds and expectations we've had for a century and a half of industrial work. And I think that is going to be a dramatic change. So we have firms that realize they can save a lot on rent because they're usually in high rent areas. Mm-hmm. And people that want to have more space may feel that they can move out of the city which they only lived in to be close to their job. We may also have the reverse of people who love urban areas who now find that they're affordable, even if their employer is not nearby. So I think we're seeing this great reshuffling take place of a sorting of people and employers based on what they want to do. It will also mean that the design of the office will change too.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go in once or twice a week to your office, you're looking at it differently than going in every day. You're looking at it as a meeting space. So a lot of those who are working in office design are not seeing sort of Cubicleville.
Right.
They're looking at, oh, we are looking for a coffee shop model where people come in one or two days a week to meet and interact.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're at home, they have the peace and quiet to do the work they need to do.
Yeah.
So
I looked at one of the spaces for Google. They actually have a place where they test out new office space innovation. And one of the things that they've added is blow up walls. So you can actually blow up a wall and create a conference room in a little area. That's pretty innovative.
A lot of innovation. And you also, if you are looking at remaking your spaces, it's like, well, there are some people who are extroverts who are happy being in the middle of an open plan. Others might want to come in for a few meetings, but don't want to necessarily be swamped with coworkers. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be all these different tastes that have to be addressed. But whatever happens, it's likely that the office will not need as much space going forward as it does now. And so the question is, what happens to that space? Can it be turned into condos? Can it be used for something else? Do we simply wait until the market catches up? We are going to see some major changes.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the consequences that I think is often missed about work from home is the impact on local taxes, because many cities have an income tax on those who work there. And what happens to those cities if you are now working 30 miles away from home in another jurisdiction that does not tax
an accounting nightmare, perhaps?
and so I know in my area, I normally pay a city tax. Mm-hmm. But because of COVID, I am classified as being in another jurisdiction and I don't have to pay city tax anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I have to keep track of my days to satisfy their demand that I know where I am every day.
Right.
But what's going to happen to those major metropolitan areas that have city taxes who now find that many of those who worked in the city don't owe taxes anymore? So that leads to a public finance crisis of how money is raised to provide the services that are needed. Against that is more people now working from home are paying more attention to their neighborhood, and they may be making more demands on their community for better services and better conditions, because they don't just sleep there anymore. They go out every day for a walk.
We got to fix these potholes, or we got to change the sidewalks so they're not uneven, or fix the,
exactly.
Oh yeah. Well, and then you got the small businesses as well that have sort of set up around office spaces, the deli counters, things like that, that are around the office spaces that they're probably hurting with this work from home, even more than just the COVID closures. They're probably having a lot of issues.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is one of these big reshuffles that's going to have to happen. And the trouble is, it's not predictable in terms of scale. And it's very difficult to say, well, how long until we know where we are? It is in process now. Mm-hmm. There are people who have quit their job in order to keep working from home, who have changed employers.
Mm-hmm.
There are those that couldn't wait to get back into the office. And so we are having this sifting of people based on their preferences and how they want to live. And so to me, this is very difficult to predict for planning purposes, because so much is in play at the same time.
Yeah, and we don't know what's going to happen. People may just decide to use these office spaces again, like work from home. Rules may change and it may go back. But let's say it doesn't. Let's say it stays this way. What do we do with that office space? I mean, is conversion to apartments, conversion to something else? Like, what else could we do with these office spaces?
We have a history has given us some good examples. Mm-hmm. And one example I find interesting is New York City, Lower Manhattan, which was a manufacturing hub up until the 40s and 50s when manufacturing left Manhattan. And it left a substantial buildings, very solidly built, but they didn't allow people to live in them.
Okay.
And so we have all of these structures, and it's the, you know, it's Chelsea, Tribeca, Soho, areas that today we love. And what happened was that they were classified as manufacturing, and only manufacturing purposes were allowed.
Okay.
And one group that got around that were artists who said, this is a commercial art studio, and I will happen to live here.
Right.
And then you get people claiming to be artists simply to get the right to live. And it eventually took over 20 years for New York City to recognize the idea of converting manufacturing space into lofts.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's going to be these lags about, is it legal or allowable for these spaces to be remade? Now, I'm hoping that we're much more agile in our planning guidelines in order to allow these changes in uses. And it is possible to retrofit spaces with some adjustments for different purposes. But then, you know, the question will always be, will people want to live downtown? Which means right. downtown doesn't thrive based on the proximity of economic interaction, like businesses and lawyers and all the services that a firm might use, to being a place where you go for entertainment and recreation and some retailing. And so cities have to be then seen as not places where people go to work. It's where people live who like density, because that density gives choice of things to do and things to go out and a centrality to moving around. And so some cities will adapt very quickly. Other cities may never recover and be hollowed out simply because they haven't found a way of reusing the office space that is now being freed up.
Well, I would think that the tax collectors in those cities would want to reshape these places so that they can begin to once again collect tax, because an empty building you're not collecting a whole lot of tax on,
you know,
as much tax as you could, I guess.
Well, the true test of a city, I think, is that vacant land isn't vacant for long.
Right.
And so there are a number of cities in the US and globally where a building becomes vacant and it's snapped up quickly and repurposed. And there are other cities, and this is especially, you know, the Midwest manufacturing cities, where functions left and no one wanted to take on the land and structures that were left. And so a test of a city's power in some ways is the ability for it to remake itself, or to those who are active in the city to remake it into something different.
Right. And I think we're seeing that actually, and we talked about this a second ago, shopping malls.
Well, yep.
Those are being remade and rethought, because those have been disrupted for several years now with Amazon and all of the online shopping. A lot of those are being converted into different types of spaces now.
And I think a lot of the shopping malls are searching for activity. So one way shopping malls adapt is by becoming focal points for experiences. So it is a place you go to eat or to see a movie or play laser tag or go to the gym. The mall has to become a place of activity rather than passive shopping. And that is certainly one function that keeps it going. Others have turned themselves into residential areas, into call centers, into offices, lots of different functions. White Flint Mall outside Washington has remade itself into a small town center with pedestrian areas and new apartments. So I could easily see a mall adding apartments, adding more social spaces like restaurants and entertainment, and being revived. But in order for that to happen, people have to allow it. They will have to want to live that way. And there can't be too much competition. In some ways, I think malls, because of the amount of space they have a lot of potential for rebuilding and remaking use. What worries me are sort of the strip malls. As you drive along major arterial roads in and out of cities, you have these single-story malls that have become vacant and very little has moved in to take them over. Yeah. And we need to encourage that. But the types of things that are likely to want to move in closer to the city center would be high density.
Right.
And many communities have very vocal groups that want to oppose any increase in density for their area because of fears that it will change the ambience of their home. And so you end up with these local planning battles over what do we use this vacant space for?
Right. Yeah, I used to, one of my first jobs was a cameraman for city council meetings. Wow. People can battle these things out until 2 a.m.
Yeah, well, I see city councils are actually going to be one of the focal points for this because it's going to be my garage is going to be an Airbnb type argument. Right. You're going to have complaints about vacant spaces, about increasing property tax to make up for lost income tax, and also the remaking of huge chunks, multiple acres of land coming onto the market.
Yeah.
That is going to be seen as desirable for development. And this is all going to have to go through the local community planning process.
Yeah. Well, that's what kind of makes this so much more difficult. There's not like a federal infrastructure plan that's going to help out and be just about your garage, you know, or that strip mall down the street. It is up to all of these individual cities and planners within each one of these cities to sort of figure this out, to rezone, change regulations, give people the ability to really do this reshuffling. It can't really be done without the local governments, I guess, right?
Yeah, and it's the responsiveness of the local government. One of the early studies we did of the internet, some communities embraced the internet, other communities resisted. But what we found is that how responsive is your state and local government to change? Does it see change coming and prepare? And we've seen this in things like climate change, where some communities are already thinking, how do we protect our residents from a surge or a rise in sea level, and other communities that are ignoring the changes that are coming. So different areas have different responsiveness modes by their officials and by their different agencies. And if they're not responsive, then they may find that the communities around them have got the early advantage and acted, and there's not much left for those that lag in responding to these changes.
Well, since there's so many local agencies involved in this, are there areas where we can perhaps learn some lessons from what people have already done?
I think that we're already seeing things like mall conversions in the US. So we can point to cities that have been thinking about the future, or developers who have actually thought, I own this property, I see that it's lifespan is likely to be dramatically reduced. What can I do with it? And I think you'll find many of those that own considerable amounts of commercial real estate are well and truly on their way to rethinking how it can be used. So there are those examples. We can also look at just different cases of what is life like in places that don't have a lot of traffic or don't have a lot of office space. How do they exist? How do they thrive? The problem is technological change is thrust upon us, and post-COVID has been thrust upon us. And anything to do with social behavior takes time to settle as we come to terms with what is the future. Yeah. And so I'm struck by, you know, some people who are saying, well, when we return to normal, well, normal is
what's that
not coming
be?
Back. Normal is not coming back. We have a post-COVID environment where we may have changed our feelings about how we live, about how we want to live, how we want to work. And then you multiply that by hundreds of millions of people who have changed in some ways how they see their working and home life. And then all of those people have to put into practice their decisions.
Right.
That's a lot to sort of just ask someone, well, what's going to happen? It's really difficult.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. And, you know, I guess, so should we be building buildings that are going to last hundreds of years, or should we be more like Las Vegas where we're putting up buildings so that we can change them in 40 years because we know so much is going to change?
Well, I'll equivocate and go in the middle of your thoughts simply because changing buildings a lot has an environmental and sustainability impact, but it does mean that the things we do build have to have more than one life, that we have to think about what will happen in the future. Now, a lot of offices were designed that way. They were modular. They could be knocked down and rebuilt in different ways so that there was a lot of flexibility. So I'm seeing that in the future, there could well be more flexibility go into the designing of spaces simply to make it easier to retrofit or manage or adapt. And I would like to see that.
Yeah,
because you don't make something for 100 years if every 20 years it's going to have a different function. But it's also wasteful to build and knock down, build and knock down.
Right, right. Well, I think Reno, actually, since I'm talking Nevada here, Reno has been a kind of a good example of a lot of the old hotels, casinos have been converted into condos, artist spaces, things like that. And I think they've done a pretty darn good job of rebuilding Reno.
Yeah, and repurposing is a great way of thinking about how we keep our cities going. We don't have the space we had 150 years ago to just go and build a new city.
Right.
We have to deal with what we've got. But I think what makes Reno work is that the planners and the local authorities were open to that.
Right.
And they facilitated it.
Right.
Whereas if you're going to throw up barriers to adaptation, then you won't adapt.
Right.
But if you facilitate adaptation, you may end up with something differently to what you've got now, but you will have something left to show for your flexibility in thinking about your community.
Right. So perhaps if people are listening and they know a city planner, send this podcast to them. So.
That's right. Remember, planners are your friend. Planners want to make your life better.
Right. It's probably more, I guess, the government officials, right? Yeah. the mayor, the city council.
Yeah.
All right, Mark, thank you so much for joining me today. I know you're doing a lot of research on disrupted cities. I don't know if you've completed all the research yet. Is there a place where somebody could go to learn more about this?
We have our website for the School of Planning, Design, and Construction at MSU, or they can contact me at wilsonmm@msu.edu, and I'd be happy to follow up with them.
Perfect. I'll put the links in the description of the podcast as well, in case you didn't get the chance to write that down. Thank you so much for joining me this week. Thanks for the Olympic talk last week. It's been fantastic. I love talking with you, Mark.
I've enjoyed it too. Thanks, Russ.
And hopefully, you know, maybe I'll be in some like cool, swanky office building condo the next time we talk. We'll see.
Let's hope.
Yeah, I will work on that. All right. Hey, thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing to Learning More. And also check out our daily podcast, This Is Today. We've got more topics for you coming up next time on Learning More. Thanks for listening.